I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
No shortage of things to talk about on The Political Breakfast this week. It is a full buffet. I'm Dennis O'Hare. I'll be your host, bringing you opinions from the left and the right. There are still weeks to go before the runoff in the Republican gubernatorial primary. We'll take a look at how that race is shaping up. Then a look at the Democratic side of things. How are they doing when it comes to building that party unity and a winning coalition in advance of the November general election? And property taxes have spiked in Fulton County. It's the latest in a long fight over assessments. Our lineup is a bit different this week. We're joined, as usual, by Democratic strategist Theron Johnson. Sitting across from him on the GOP side, Chuck Clay. He served for close to a decade in the state Senate back in the 1990s, and then he was chair of the state GOP. He's now with the law firm of Hall Booth Smith. Greetings to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's take a look at, now that we've sorted through the debris of the primary, Chuck, I'm going to start with you. The Republican runoff, you have Casey Cagle rolling up a big margin, but short of the 50% plus one he needed to win without a runoff. Brian Kemp ready to go with more commercials, apparently. So what's the path to victory for both of them at this point?
Well, the traditional rule has always been, and I know Theron's been around this long enough to say that if you're the leader, if you're the top dog, if you're sort of looked at as the quasi front runner, 40 is about the bare minimum to be in a place where you'd still say the big mo is on your side.
Yeah.
Now, the other side of that is Brian's a little bit lower than where Nathan was in the run against Handel. They're still in a 10 or 11% gap. But my rule is under 40. Now, you can always say buying a car $39.99, but $39.99 is still under 40. I say that not to say that he's in trouble, but it is a real race, is what I'm trying to say.
Where does he go? Casey Cagle. Where does he go to get votes?
He won strongly in the areas you have to run strongly in to win a runoff, if not a primary, certainly a runoff. Kanemaw, Gwinnett, Cobb, Cherokee, Forsyth. Probably you'd go down the list. Paulding on down of these strongholds. He won them all. Now, Brian's strategy, sort of take the other side of that, he ran a, quote, rural strategy. I haven't looked at the numbers well enough to know, is that what got him there? Maybe the two veterans, the SEAL, the Ranger, thanks both to the service.
Hunter Hill and Clay Tipton.
Sort of blocked themselves out, if you will. But nevertheless, Kemp has got now to get into those urban, suburban households, not the hard right. You got to get those suburban housewives. Maybe the gun ads helped them in rural Georgia. This is just anecdotal, but I had a number of neighbors say, oh, I can't do that. So he's got to do better there.
Well, the argument is that the people who are going to show up on a runoff in the middle of the summer, 9 weeks after the primary, are the people who are really motivated. So
true.
That might be good news for Brian Kemp.
There's no question about that. It is slandered in both parties. With a 5% vote, you get what you get. So it's voter turnout. Turning out your voters, GOTV. But Brian has got to look more suburban, if you will. Casey's got to just focus on fundamental, get out the troops. You're right. A lot of the fair weather friends were not friends at all. They stay home.
Theron, as you're watching this from the Democratic side, but you're a strategist, you love this kind of planning and theorizing. What do you think is going to happen?
I think we're going to see more of what we saw during the primary from Brian Kemp. I mean, it was clearly a strategy that he had to enact some Trumpian tactics in Georgia at a time when he was in third and fourth place. So I don't think he abandons that strategy. So I think that we will see more and more ads that are going to be very provocative. It's going to continue to be a race to the right. But I do agree with my good friend Chuck that if Brian Kemp has any shot of winning this, he's got to get some support in the metropolitan areas. Now, let's turn to Cagle. I totally agree with Chuck as well that if you have 61% of the people who voted for someone else, conventional wisdoms and runoffs that I've been is that there's usually a 50-50 split on the hardcore people who are definitely coming back out. What Cagle has got to be able to do is that he's got to seek the endorsements, and Kemp has got to do this as well. They got to try to seek the endorsements of Hunter Hill and Clay Tempest, and believe it or not, even Michael Williams, who was a person who
did not 5% or something like that.
Yeah, but that 5% can be the difference. And then I think the other thing is that what I'm really waiting on, Dennis, is what is Governor Deal going to do? What is Senator Isaacson going to do, and what is Senator Perdue is going to do.
Let's start with Governor Deal, who I think has already made it clear he's not endorsing, at least right now.
Well, yeah, and his chief—
That speaks volumes.
Yeah, that speaks volumes. And I think that, you know, he and the other two senators from Georgia want these two conservative gentlemen to battle it out themselves and let them have a very fair fight, and whoever wins, they'll support the nominee. But I think that this race continues to get more and more provocative. And the governor's chief of staff has come out and said that if you try to distort or discredit this governor's record in any type of way, they will respond in order to protect Governor Deal's legacy. And so I think the tone is going to really be set on how provocative, how to the right are the ads going to be from Kemp. And more importantly, how does Casey Cagle respond to them? And if the record of Governor Deal is injected, and if we start seeing this race getting a lot of national attention, whether the two U.S. senators decide to jump in.
Chuck, when you were chair of the Republican GOP, you watched as the Democrats splintered some years ago when Kathy Cox and Mark Taylor engaged in a bitter runoff fight.
Brutal.
Is there a risk that that could happen to the Republicans, and then because of hard feelings and low turnout among the faithful, hand the governor's mansion to the Democrats, or do you think Republicans are really worried about that?
I have nothing but respect for the Democrat nominee. Always said, you know, we shared one thing in common. We were both minority leaders. The only job in politics that has neither carrot nor stick. So I have a great deal of sort of sympathy and an admiration of one who's done it as well as she has. I don't think the governor's mansion is going to change Democrat. But that doesn't mean what you're saying could not occur. The bitterer the race, the more the scar tissue carries over. And it doesn't just carry over in that race. It carries over somewhat down the ballot. Worse, though, sometimes it carries into the future. And that starts somebody off in the governor's mansion, whoever the winner might be, with some baggage.
Which is interesting because we think, and Theron, both of you really would know this, because we think of, oh, okay, one-party control automatically means it's smooth sailing for a governor who wants to pass his or her legislation. But we can remember going back to Republican control right after they took over when there was a fight over Casey Cagle and what his control would be in the Senate. Or going farther back when the Democrats ran everything, then Lieutenant Governor Zell Miller and House Speaker Tom Murphy were at each other all the time. So one party
control.
And
now one time did they reach out to me to say, solve this, Chuck.
They didn't come to you.
They just didn't reach out and say, we need you, man. We need you on this conference committee.
But so one of the things, Dennis, that we also got to look at is we saw this happen before when Senator David Perdue and former Congressman Jack Kingston had a pretty brutal runoff as
they
well.
Did.
And our nominee at the time, the Democrats' nominee, was Michelle Nunn. And so the primary went on between those two Republicans. And what happened is that the electorate saw a lot of issues, saw a lot of airtime of Senator Perdue, who came out with some very good ads. And so what Abrams cannot do, and I know we're going to get to the Democrats, but the Democrats' challenge is, yes, the Republicans are going to spend millions and millions of dollars beating up on one another during this primary runoff, and it's going to get very nasty, and it's going to give the Democrats some ammunition to attack them further.
But people are going to see them.
But Abrams' campaign has got to basically figure out a way to continue to earn media, continue to stay out there, run her strategy, and to stay in front of people while this 9-week runoff is going on the Republican side.
So, Theron, let's pick this up then. Stacey Abrams wins the Democratic primary, wins over Stacey Evans convincingly. What's her path to victory And it is a narrow one given the fact that this is still a Republican state.
I mean, this was a dominant win by Stacey Abrams. She not only won the Democratic primary, I mean, it was a mandate. And I want to say thank you to Stacey Evans for, you know, her hard work and what she did during the campaign. And more importantly, she came right out and endorsed Stacey Abrams.
Yeah, there was a love fest right after that.
It was. And to me, as a Democrat, it was really good to see that. And I really want to thank everyone involved for creating this sort of unified front as we get ready to go as a ticket to go against the Republicans. Stacey Abrams has made it very clear, Dennis, that she is not going to abandon a strategy that she think not only worked in the primary, but she thinks that it will work in the general. She has used terms like "I'm unapologetically a progressive." She truly believes that there's a progressive movement in this state. It is a blue wave here. And I think if you look at that 76% mandate victory, she clearly did something out of the ordinary to get that big of a margin in the primary. So I think that she's going to continue her grassroots strategy of retail politics, going out, talking to sporadic voters who usually don't vote in Democratic primaries and gubernatorial elections in the general. But she's also got appeal to moderate white independent voters.
That's a pretty interesting needle to thread. If you're going to say I'm an unapologetic progressive, that is a strategy where you're going to have to get every single progressive vote while still appealing across the aisle without alienating those progressives. That's not the easiest thing to do.
So the thing is that the progressive movement, the progressive dollars.
Theron can do it.
Thank you, Chuck. That's a huge vote of confidence. The progressive movement and progressive dollars are going to have to allow her to do that at the time that she feels the most comfortable. But I believe this, Dennis. A lot of disaffected Republicans that I talk to in this state, many of whom may support the good policies that this president has put forth, but doesn't support his unhinged behavior and his tactics of insulting people and really sort of having a lot of implicit biases in some of his rhetoric. I think that they're really discouraged with the Republican Party as is. And what Donald Trump has done is that he's caused a lot of dissension amongst the party primary conservative right. However, I do think that the independent voters in this state are more progressive than they were, say, 4, 8, 12 years ago.
But are there enough of them at this point to put Stacey Abrams over the top?
So the next thing she's going to have to do. So don't abandon your strategy that got you here. Appeal to moderates as best you can. And then she's going to have to expand the electorate. We know mathematically right now that a Democrat in this state is going to receive 1 million votes. But there's always that 250,000 to 300,000 vote gap. So how does she expand the electorate enough? How does she bring out new voters? How does she maybe get some people who usually don't vote in gubernatorial elections, who only vote in presidential elections, to come out? Therein lies the three-pronged strategy I think she's got to implement.
Chuck, then the Republicans have to emphasize unity, even though they are on paper in a more comfortable position.
You always do. That's about ABC's fundamental politics. I mean, the state is not ready to take, in my view, a progressive, true progressive tact, if you will. But I also say I can see success when success is occurring. Republicans need to ensure, let me tell you something, sometimes you lose by losing, but you can win occasionally by losing. And whether it's Stacey Abrams or Stacey Evans, they're A candidates that Republicans do need to be concerned about because both have them a certain appeal, and it's a legitimate appeal. So I don't think that needle's going to be thread this time, but I also don't think either one of them is going away. Republicans have got to get away from those the ads and the features and the generalizations, in some cases the realities, in some cases just the not reality, imaginary sort of views on immigration, on other things that are important in primaries. We got to build.
One of the things that Theron mentioned was President Trump. Do you think that the Democrats would be making a mistake to make President Trump the issue here? Or do Georgia Republicans, whether they like the president or not, vote for state offices based on other things.
What week is it? Or what day, maybe? Yeah. And I could give you a better answer. I do think, particularly, we'll see what happens with the Korea meeting. We'll see what continue to happen with the economy. See what happens on immigration issue. Is there finally some way to move that issue forward, not abandoning positions, but making it look in a way that we're trying to uniformly and fairly and mercifully enforce laws while at the same time growing the nation and bringing talented people here. So I don't think they're abandoning ship as yet, but personally, just me, Chuck Clay, if there was some way to turn off the tweet machine or whatever, I would be a much comfortable Republican.
Really quick, Dennis, I think the other thing is this, is that it can be about Trump, but it also got to be about Georgia issues. And what's your solution to the Georgia issues? One of the things that Abrams has talked a lot about is the expansion of Medicaid. And I think there is a political will on both sides of the aisle to try to expand Medicaid. It's all about how you do it and how you're going to fund it.
And do you call it that, or do you work out some other deal with the feds, that kind of thing?
So she's going to have to figure out a way to either let third parties or her campaign amplify the negativity around Donald Trump. But it can't just be about that. She's got to gaff some specific Georgia solutions to the issues that we face.
And Chuck, real quickly, is it a mistake for the Republican candidates to say absolutely no deal on any form of Medicaid expansion, any compromise at all?
Personally, no. I think it has to be more nuanced than that, because the fact of the matter is there's about going to be a billion-dollar plus hole that has to be picked up directly by the taxpayers of every state out there if we don't find some other basic fundamental way to deliver services to those that quite candidly need it.
Real quickly on this subject, but I think it's important to bring up one issue that came up just in the last couple of days. Save the Children came out with a study that says rural Georgia again ranks very high among states around the country in the rate of childhood poverty. Again, we're in Atlanta, so rural Georgia often gets overlooked, but this could be a big issue in the governor's race eventually.
It's always been an issue. It's been an issue as long as I've been around here. There are some areas that have gotten better. There's some areas that, because of location and economic infrastructure, it's just gotten worse. When you have counties with 5,000 people, schools with less than 800, 500 people in an entire school system, the challenges are great when it comes to everything that's out there. Can it be an issue? Of course it can be an issue. The bulk of the voters are elsewhere, but your heart goes, there has to be solutions. They're not giveaway like Medicaid. You can't just give money away. You've got to have a delivery system that works, that provides health care. You got to have economic development in rural Georgia, but you got to build that infrastructure structure to get it.
Theron, Democrats lost rural Georgia in the last few decades. Is this a possible opening for them?
Absolutely. And this is something that sort of peaked its head a little bit in the Democratic primary discussions between Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans. But I think that Abrams' campaign has got to be looking at this very closely. But I agree with Chuck. I think this is something that's been going on in Georgia for a very long time. And I think it's sort of centered around jobs. You know, we know that if you give a family a job, if a man or a woman or a same-sex couple have an opportunity to have access to a job, then that helps reduce child poverty. And I think also if we look at some of the rural challenges around education and particularly around health care and them not having jobs to basically be able to afford adequate health care, I think that's some issue that we've got to have a good conversation about around the state, and I think it's something that Democrats
just want to make sure that neither one of us sound like we're sort of Jane Fonda, tar paper shacks type of thing. And I know he does too. We care about rural Georgia. There's great people. There's great opportunity. They do need help. You can define how you want to do it, but if you don't have broadband, you're not breaking jobs. And so Georgia has got to do better for rural Georgia to be what they can be.
And that was an issue in the last session of the legislature. It'll be back again no matter who wins
the
governor's race. More of the Political Breakfast just ahead, so keep your seat at the table. We'll be right back.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org. Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
We are back on The Political Breakfast, filling in for Brian Robinson today. Chuck Clay, former state senator, former chair of the Georgia Republican Party, now with the law firm of Hall Booth Smith. And Theron Johnson, Democratic strategist and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Fulton County became sort of the poster child for this, but other counties in the Atlanta area are going to face this as well. Chuck, I'll start with you because you're a former county commissioner in Cobb. Fulton County homeowners are going to be looking at huge increases in their property assessments. In other words, the estimate of what their property is worth. That is the basis for how high your taxes go. There's going to be a lot of blowback on this in Fulton, but Fulton's not alone here, is it? I mean, Cobb, DeKalb, other fast-growing counties.
Everybody's got fundamental financial issues. In Cobb's case, it's a $30 million shortfall. We can argue pros and cons. Not many careers were made in these suburban counties by raising taxes. That's not a winning platform in a Republican primary. But Fulton County is different. I don't want to comment on somebody else's. We know the issues extending back, whether right or wrong. There's been a history of just credibility issues. I don't think it's a credibility
office, yeah.
In a Cobb or maybe it is DeKalb or not. But say Cobb because I know it. It's an issue of is it time for, and there's a lot of people who now think it is time for a millage increase that it will make certain people mad. It will cost maybe some votes out there substantially if a boy wants to run again. But they've got to either cut $30 million raise $30 million, or their bond rating is going to start suffering.
Mike Boyce, the Cobb Commission chair, and you raise an interesting point, though. You're saying, okay, people are going to be already looking at rises in their assessments. So even if the tax rate stays the same, their bill's going to go up. But you're also saying maybe they have to raise the rate, too, which is a double whammy, isn't
it? It is. And there's no question that that is the downside, the other side of the sword of economic development out in these areas, because every one of us sees the bill go up and say, why are we raising millage? You got $700 million dollars
new
or $300 million or $100 million, depending on where you are. So
this is what gentrification looks like. I mean, we know that property taxes in Fulton County have been frozen since 2016. And the harsh reality is that it cannot be frozen forever. So I think at a time when we know that this was coming, I think the county has got to make sure that the taxpayers, that we have confidence in the assessor's office and that this is
being— And you're talking about Fulton specifically.
Fulton County, yeah, specifically. But also is that I do think there should be some relief for homeowners who are struggling to basically bear this tax increase.
And so, how do you define who gets the relief, though?
Well, and I think that, you know, there's been this long-term solution around homestead exemption, but that only plays a certain part in the relief. And so we've got to figure out the metrics. We've got to figure out the formula to determine who deserves that relief. I believe that there is a certain segment of Fulton County, particularly in the north, who make a little bit more money because Fulton County is a booming county where people want to live. So therefore, when people are selling houses, people are moving into neighborhoods and building new houses, the property taxes and the taxes go up. But I do think that there's got to be a way to kind of approach this with a huge level of sensitivity to the homeowners who have been here long term. There's also going to be a process in place where people are going to appeal their tax assessments that they just received in the mail these last couple weeks. And so I think this process is going to be ongoing. But I think that conversations are going to have to be had about raising the millage rate, which is something that a lot of people are talking about. But how do we continue to provide relief to the homeowners who need it the most?
And services increase. And I would like to say places like Cobb, not only, but you got to remember they have exempted a large swath of, in many cases, quite upper income folks from having to pay any school taxes, which is 70-80% of your tax bill to start with. So
they're in a bind.
And I'm all for it. I think it's great because I now fit in that category. but I will say I'm starting to hear some discussion about those types of programs and impacts. There's an upside, but there is a downside.
And with some slight variations in what the specific issues are in general, these issues are facing not just Cobb and Fulton, but DeKalb, Gwinnett, even Clayton, some of the other counties around the Atlanta area. Looking at the national scene for a moment, Trey Gowdy, South Carolina congressman and the man who headed up the Benghazi investigation, basically knocked the legs, Chuck, out from under President Trump's notion that there was a spy gate, an informant in the Trump campaign who was spying on the campaign. There was an FBI informant who was looking into whether the Russians were trying to interfere in the elections via the Trump campaign. And so with that, with what Trey Gowdy has done, Georgia Republicans who have tied themselves to the president, are they at a point where they have to perhaps nuance their position a little bit, say, okay, I support him on policy, but I'm going to wait and see on the investigation?
A handful, but this is such a visceral issue. I am one who tends to believe that, cut the nonsense. I mean, the level of hoopla that's gone around, something that's indicted people, but none of them what we thought the investigation was about. Doesn't mean they won't. On Spygate, if Trey Gowdy says it, I tend to believe it because I have enormous respect for his background and his professionalism. Doesn't change the fundamental playing ground, in my view. It's a little bit overhyped Spygate. Mm-hmm. Probably let it fizzle out anyway, but at some point in time in the greater scheme of things, it's just going to be subsumed to whether you hate Trump, that never Trump, or it's all a fake news.
But if the president continues to go after the FBI, which is headed by a former Atlantan, Chris Wray, what do Georgia Republicans do? Because they have for years staked themselves on saying we have to ensure the strength and the independence of our law enforcement community.
It's true, but again, it's so 60,000 foot for your average, working stiff out in the world. It's not to say this isn't important, but it's not what's driving the electorate.
Right. Theron?
I think that we have seen a series of valuable factual information that's been presented to the American people, that there was clear communications from the Trump campaign and his advisors and his senior staff with Russian hostile people who was trying to basically throw this election in favor of Donald Trump. This new development further shows that there was a cover-up and a series of lies from President Trump and his campaign people about the level of communications and possible collusion that was going on between what the campaign was communicating to the president, but also what the president knew at the time when it was communicated to him about his campaign's activity in coordination with Russia. But now what is very interesting to me about Republicans is that we just went through about a month of Rudy Giuliani and others trying to basically get out in front of this story that they knew was coming, that was going to gain more and more credibility to this Mueller investigation. The challenge is that the president is so good with just dominating the media and making this sort of Spygate / witch hunt believable to his conservative base. But I think that American people are smarter than that. And when you see a series of factual information coming from the FBI and people who are investigating the possible collusion and conspiring that went on during the 2016 presidential election, I think that we just can't ignore it. Now, here's the truth. Here's a harsh reality. I do agree with Chuck. I think that the base of the Republican Party now is no longer the Republican Party, it's the Trump Party. And these are people who have just been so angry, who have been such against the establishment for so long, they don't want to believe the true reality that's in front of them. So,
but will it affect Georgia Republicans, really? Or as Chuck is saying, do most voters, whether they like the president or not, really care about other issues when they're looking at these Georgia Republicans?
I think that voters care about this, Dennis. They probably don't care about it as much as we do as insiders, but it's definitely something that they're not proud of. They're not proud of that our country, the country that we all love, the country that is the most powerful nation in the universe, has the possibility of convening conversations and cooperating with a Russian hostile dictatorship that has been there for many, many times that have been trying to do harm to Americans. As far as the people here in Georgia, Republicans, I don't think they abandoned the president just yet, but I definitely think that their staff members and their advisors are saying, hey, we need to sort of walk carefully about how we align ourselves to this president in regards to this investigation.
Most of us, I would just leave it with the word that, and I could be proven wrong, but you're going to wind up with every single human being in America indicted, but one not, and that'd be Donald Trump. I think he's going to be the only one who walks away from this unharmed in any way, shape, form, or fashion, no matter how at one level dislikable you might find him. I'm waiting to see, and it does keep the American voters in question and limbo. It's got to be resolved.
One last thing. HQ2. We think it's kind of like the Mueller investigation in one way, Chuck, is that we think it's going to wrap up sometime soon. Amazon's going to make its announcement. We've heard lots of rumors about what might be happening, but Atlanta and its place in the running for HQ2, we really don't know. And Governor Deal had to address that earlier this week.
Every Georgian, of course, we would like to have a 50,000 employee facility job location here. I've always been skeptical, and I sound like every sort of, knee-jerk conservative, but I've always been skeptical of Northwest liberals really wanting truly to come and live in the Deep South. They like to talk about how we should each accordingly live and act and react, but I'm not sure I see many of them just lining up to want to be down here and actually rub shoulders with us, Harvard level types in the South.
Theron, when the site visit happened, there were rumors that it didn't go all that well, but of course we didn't know how it went with the other cities. And now the rumors again are that, well, Georgia might not be in such bad shape. But again, we really don't know anything that you're hearing.
My sources are telling me that the visit did go well. And more importantly, the follow-up from the visit has been really well.
Heard that too. Good point.
And it's been a collaboration between both the Georgia Chamber of Commerce, the Metro Chamber of Commerce, Mayor Bottoms, Governor Deal, and Invest Atlanta. All the different economic development agencies have come together and have been in constant communication.
And they are great. That's a great team.
And so I think what I heard Governor Deal say, and I heard his chief of staff, Chris Riley, say it down in St. Simon's recently, is that he really walked us through the consistency of being the number one place to do business in the nation and really talked about the job growth. I do disagree a little bit with my friend Chuck. A lot of these people that you describe that may or may not want to move here, they are already here. And I think that's one of the reasons why Amazon is looking at Georgia, because we do have this sort of different millennial, well-trained workforce of people who want to live in the city, who want to live in this metro area. And so I think we're definitely still in the running. I think we're going to give it everything we got. If we can just tone down the rhetoric a little bit on the Republican side, and maybe if Kemp doesn't blow up so much in his new commercials in the runoff, maybe we'll still have a shot. But if I continue to see things blowing up and pickup trucks that are shutting down on the expressway and these M13.
Well, that was Michael Williams. Now.
Leave out the chainsaw.
We had the chainsaw.
We'll be cutting those regs and bring Amazon here.
And guns, you know, pointed at, or maybe not pointed at, young, you know, high school students, then I think we still have a shot.
Let me say, I would be thrilled. I mean, it was being a little facetious. I would love to have Amazon here. The team is great. Atlanta is a millennial town, and Theron's right. We produce. People want to live in town. They want to have transportation. They don't want to get in their car every day, and they love companies like Amazon for all the obvious reasons. Great company.
That's it for this week's Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare. We've been joined by Democratic strategist Theron Johnson and former GOP State Chairman Chuck Clay. Thanks to you both.
It was an honor to be here with both of you.
Thank you, Dennis. Always good to see you.
And thanks to producer Sam Whitehead. If you liked this show, subscribe, and you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure that other people can find us. We'll be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.